Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for March 26th, 2012. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a newscast in which I talk about some of the stories from the past couple of weeks that caught my attention, I thought would be worth digging into, including a discussion based on some research around whether multi-word passphrases are more or less secure than random passwords. Even a toddler, apparently, is smarter than the smartest AI, and how this actually may be a source of inspiration for future research, considering an alternative to the Pirate Bay's plan for file-sharing drones, and the good news, the glad tidings, that the Open3DP project out of University of Washington is once again open, not just in name. All of this and more. First, though, before I get into any of that, I wanted to give a brief travel update. I think it's about time to give another reminder that I'm going to be once again a panelist, a participant at BaltCon coming up Memorial Day weekend here in the U.S. If you're in the Mid-Atlantic region, in particular near D.C. or Baltimore, Maryland, I encourage you to come out. I'm going to be speaking tentatively about copyright, about the role of social media and public policy. I'm very excited for that topic, a new addition. A really cool idea suggested by the track director around new media this year. I'll also be reprising the homebrewing panel, hopefully, and doing, I think, a beta of a talk that I would like to do at Ohio Linux Fest later in the year as well. More of a presentation on my process as a free Libra and open source podcaster and how I use all open and all free software from top to bottom, back to front. I have to get thoughts on all of those assembled in the next month or so in preparation for that. So that's going to be perhaps a bit of a scramble, a little further out though, in early June, actually maybe not that too much more distant than Balticon within a week or so. I have another big whirlwind tour of Europe coming up. The dates for that are tentative at this point, but it is looking like it's going to be around June 5th to the 13th, and stops will include Athens, they will include Paris, and London at this point. Athens and Paris are definite. London is a maybe. Not sure. As we get closer, I will definitely firm up and share the dates for any listeners who are in those areas or nearby who might either have some travel recommendations or might even want to meet up. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. Renowned security expert Bruce Schneier linked to a study of multiple word passphrases that made the rounds a couple of weeks ago with tons of comments and questions. He linked to both the research and a more accessible blog post on the site Light Blue Touch Paper that pretty clearly explains the counterintuition that has so many people confused here. While passphrases have the potential to be far more secure, what the researchers actually looked at was the limited data that could be found that demonstrates how such phrases are actually used versus their theoretical upper bound. This is comparable to some of the statistical work on passwords that has been done over the years, especially in the wake of public disclosures and some anonymized intentional data releases intended to fuel better security research. The theoretical strength can be computed for both passwords and phrases and expressed in terms of bits of entropy. The higher that entropy, the more guesses, essentially a brute force attack, a randomly guessing approach, has to make in order to get it right, thus increasing the cost of attacks against any given password or phrase. Not surprisingly, as with the more common single-word choices, the researchers found in practice that the actual choices of multiple words and phrases simply didn't yield that much security. Too often, what users selected were predictable word pairs that occur not on a dictionary per se, but that the results of analysis of massive quantities of text, like Google's n-grams derived from their book digitization project, yield the same sort of advantages for passphrases that dictionary attacks do for single words. The takeaway for me is that the important bit of security advice is not necessarily length, so much as it is ensuring that the words or phrases used are sufficiently random so as to erase any advantages from the sorts of cribs that can be derived to aid attackers from dictionaries and other easily accessible and processed textual metadata. The XKCD comic mentioned in the post is also a good example, one that couples pure random word choices with what I think is a key here, a clever trick in this instance to aid memory without eroding a phrase's strength. Sean Gallagher at Ars Technica shared an interesting study from Ponemon Institute sponsored by Symantec. It followed 49 organizations over the course of last year, 2011. The focus of the study was the cost of data breaches, that is, when something occurs for one reason or another, resulting in acquisition by a third party, sometimes malicious, not always, of a personal data stored at a particular company. This is a finding that, in general, they found to decline the frequency over the course of last year. It's broken out by the cause of the breach, though, and in doing so, the cost for malicious hacks then rose when partitioned out compared to other reasons behind these breaches, like software faults or negligence on behalf of the caretakers of customer data. The results also pointed to an increase in active attacks as opposed to the passive causes. I find those two a bit hard to reconcile, although I imagine there are numbers that could be plugged into those statements that would make them true, unless the drop in cost for non-attack breaches dropped so much that it drastically offset the admittedly modest 6% increase cited by Gallagher, and you can find in the abstract of the report as well, in increasing those breaches resulting from attacks. Beyond what Gallagher summarizes, there are a few other highlights in the study itself, just within the first handful of pages. In particular, are called out that having a C-level executive in an organization responsible for handling these breaches tends to correlate with lowered costs in taking care of them. The researchers also broke out the different parts of cost per incidence. In particular, the cost to detect and then escalate handling of a breach went down overall, but the cost of notifying those affected by breaches went up. That last, to me, is a bit suspicious as it echoes rhetoric from companies objecting to regulations from the FTC and others that would mandate customer notification in the wake of a breach, here citing exactly this reasoning, a prohibitive cost in doing so. Overall, though, I'd limit credibility in the study as it was based on self-reported surveys. To be more reproducible and perhaps more objective as a consequence, there, I think, needs to be a corollary study that uses some more concrete data, like logs from deployed security systems versus information that companies themselves feed into the analysis. Additionally, the trends identified seem to be cyclic, that within the last 6 years or so, the aspects examined, largely costs, fell out along similar distributions, so it seems in many ways that we've circled back to the state the industry was in just a handful of years ago. I would also like to see a cost-to-consumer analysis rather than just cost-to-company, as individuals have less recourse, such as insurance and accounting tricks, to soften the blow of some lost bit of personal identification or financial data. Here are the news stories that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website at thecommandline.net. Megan Goose, maybe it's Geuss, G-E-U-S-S, at Ars Technica wrote about a project at Imperial College in the UK by PhD student Michael Cook, who is studying evolutionary computing. Very quickly, since the article only provides a cursory explanation of that topic, this is a form of computation-based optimization that mimics natural evolution. A programmer provides one or more fitness functions. The program then iteratively generates code and evaluates its function against these criteria. The more successful bits are kept, the ones that fail are discarded. The approach relies on the brute horsepower of computers to iterate and evaluate these simple rules. Surprisingly, with the right fitness functions, good results can emerge, and rapidly, and often to the astonishment of those actually running these sorts of systems, things that standard programming approaches might not have come across. There are additional techniques, also cribbed from nature, that improve the capabilities, such as introducing forms of random variation or mutation, and also simulating sexual reproduction, where fit programs swap pieces in the form of some sort of DNA or genes with other fit programs within the same generation to see if recombining subsets of successful traits improves fitness in the next generation. Geese does make clear that creating programs in this fashion doesn't represent any kind of reasoning like fuzzy logic or what IBM's well-known Watson executes to take on, say, Jeopardy champions. Cook's application highlights where evolutionary programming perhaps can outperform other approaches that emulate more classical reasoning models. Angelina, which stands for a novel game evolving lab rat I've named Angelina, yeah, nice bit of tail recursion there, uses a simulated evolution to produce novel and ideally fun-to-play video games. The application of randomization and even constrained and optimized forms of it isn't new in the video game space. Many of them over the years have included the capability to produce random maps, levels, and to inject random challenges like monsters and other discrete elements of gameplay. What makes Angelina different is that it produces entire games, albeit very simple ones right now. Geese has an excellent description in the article of how Cook decomposed games into three independently evolvable components or species. Some of these, like the map layouts and placement of enemy sprites, borrow from that long lineage of random generation, but add an evaluation of playability or fun. The fact that the rules also are permuted is the most interesting to me, that doing so could possibly lead to some counterintuitive and genuinely new games as a consequence. Manual game design relies on a well-established body of knowledge. It seems like every so often a creator stumbles upon something truly new, some new element injected into these classical mix of bits of games, or remixes those pieces in a surprising way that yields a really novel experience. Leveraging randomization, optimization, and models of what makes a game fun to play unleashes a program like Angelina to try combinations that may never have occurred to a human designer. Better yet, I like the idea that it could provide a prod or a spur away from a lot of what we're seeing in terms of Me Too games, ones that simply feed into the desire to capitalize on a proven game already in existence out in the market by just offering more of the same, reproducing gameplay, very similar characters and the like. The games created by Angelita are simple, equivalent to early arcade games and platformers like the very first versions of the long-running Mario franchise. Cook has hopes that game makers will consider making use of his work in the games that they're producing, and it isn't hard to imagine how something like this could offer an unpredictable string of unique and engaging games for lower-powered mobile devices where casual gaming is becoming ever more popular. It's a little harder, as Megan notes in the article, to see some of the more rambling and immersive and involved first-person shooters and multiplayer online role-playing games and the like being replaced by something like this. But there is a whole new class of games that a lot of people are increasingly very interested in with the adoption of mobile devices where this could make a lot of sense. I can also imagine how this work could be built upon, how other game aspects could be abstracted away into evolvable species, realizing that ultimate potential that I think resides here for real surprise, even if, as the article notes, humans may still need to be creative and involved to add visual and other multimedia skins and set dressing. Alistair Wilkins on IO9 describes some other work in the same field of AI or of fundamental approaches, here more so to human reasoning than just sort of the biomimicry in the last piece. The work being done by Tom Griffiths and colleagues at UC Berkeley's Computational Cognitive Science Labs takes its inspiration from natural systems, actually just like the last story about Angelina, the difference being is what they take as their original muse. Instead of starting with an immense macro system that can be simply simulated way faster than it occurs in the natural world and its counterpart there, Wilkins opens the article with a fun description of these researchers' point of departure. A relatively unexamined model of building general reasoning almost from scratch is how human children grapple with and make sense of the world from birth onwards. Wilkins does a good job pinpointing the differences between the way a mature adult reasons versus the sort of challenges an infant faces just in sorting out vast quantities of new experiences with little to no prior experience. Griffiths and team are looking to assemble statistical models that work like the sorts of techniques that infants use to discover causal relationships, notice patterns, and test hypotheses. To me, though Wilkins doesn't put it this way, this sounds like reverse engineering the basic wiring with which children come equipped as a result of generations on generations of adaptive evolution. The article explains that the real-world benefits will be in much more flexible computer interactions. Think of voice response systems better able to deal with unusual interactions or other forms of automation that can adapt to the conditions of a person using them and injecting those surprising elements that often cause today's systems to go off the rails in very frustrating ways. Wilkins has a little fun imagining the best attributes of children imbued in programs like a sense of wonder and the pursuit of creative play and imagination. As fun as those ideas are, speaking as a parent, I think Griffiths and team are better off doing what it definitely sounds like is a probabilistic approach rather than emulating any form of emotional intelligence. That's all we need is a rampaging, a tantrum-throwing computer acting like a 2 or 3-year-old. To be fair, there are researchers who have also been looking into emotive computing in a more constructive vein, more to trigger empathic responses and find models of interaction that are ultimately less tasking to their operators. What is being done here isn't new as a rough concept in terms of trying to go back to a sort of first principles approach to practical reasoning. The difference compared to, say, artificial neural networks and the training thereof is that they are targeting intermediate features of childlike reasoning. Rather than simulating completely blank neurons and trying to evoke emergent self-organizing wiring of those into useful cognitive systems, they're focusing on existing capabilities hardwired into human beings at birth as a function of a developmental biology and evolution. Doing so may limit their approach in that it may be permanently stuck at a child's level of development, but this may be good enough for the sort of applications that they are targeting. Conversely, they or subsequent researchers may layer in other techniques that produce a hybrid model of reasoning that nets some useful general machine reasoning as the end result. The other thought I had was how these open-ended and conjectural models may benefit from the vast speed-up at play in the last story. We've already seen how the application of non-cognitive-focused simple statistical models to the currently almost faddish trend of big data has yielded some surprising insights. Imagine how even a marginal step towards human-level reasoning, coupled with the ability to take in orders of magnitude more information and experience that a human at that stage could do, once again may yield something truly unexpected. Corey at Boing Boing shared a talk given by Matt Howey at Webstock in New Zealand recently. Howey started his career during the original dot-com boom and is the person responsible for the site Metafilter, and as he was coming up with the ideas in the talk, is about to turn 40. Not surprisingly, I was immediately interested as we are clearly of an age, as my own 40th birthday is less than a year away at this point. In the intro, Howey provides a bit of context about the kind of milestone that this particular age represents in the U.S. as well as in other cultures like in New Zealand. The first thing that occurred to me as he continued to talk about his peers going through a similar sort of readjustment as they approach 40 was how compressed all the changes in their lives are. I don't really feel that my own approach to this particular threshold is quite so condensed in the same way. I suspect, though, that I am unusual, that I've been defensive of my work-life balance from a much earlier age, even I think maybe as far back as into my late 20s. Howie lays some fault at the feet of, Steve Jobs, who is both, to be fair, inspiring, clearly, but demanding of himself in many of the stories about him and those definitely around him, encouraging, ultimately, in being that way, a pretty unbalanced life when it comes to professional development. He draws a clear line from that attitude towards work into the pervasive culture of Silicon Valley. This definitely matches my experience, the last of which was at an industry conference a couple of years ago that I went to, where the attitude of the 20-year-olds I was bumping into was they'd work at a rising startup, one that could afford to send them to participate and even present at these conferences with very little industry experience, where they would do that long enough to secure a fortune and then either start their own gangbusters endeavor or get out of technology altogether and retire by the time they were 30. And when you put it in those very blunt terms, I hope that you get a sense of just how floored I was by this attitude. In contrast, Howie offers the minimalist view he's come to in response to that, of building just what he calls the minimally viable application that has some residual value to it. He suggests that the attention of obviously lucrative success may introduce a distortion that hides smaller, still interesting and worthwhile ideas. There's a term used as a pejorative from venture capitalists that these small efforts are lifestyle businesses. As dismissive as the money people are, Howie identifies a modest but solid growth trend in this area and maybe offers an alternate take, an alternate connotation on that term that's not quite so down or marginalizing. He credits a long-term view as key to these underappreciated ideas and implementations. A good bulk of the talk then unpacks the differences between the massive internet hits that everybody thinks of in the space of modern software development and those models that are perhaps more sustainable, more sane when it comes to the health and sanity of the people involved. The comparison to indie bands is a particularly good one, I think, both in terms of the additional work required to be successful, but also how much a company can retain of its own value, how much ownership all of the people involved can hang on to, and then how much they can chart their own destiny and make their own decisions. Early on, I was introduced to the idea of dilution, the height of a concern being one of the last startups for whom I worked, that arguably took at least some of these lessons to heart, avoiding outside investment for as long as possible in order to retain that autonomy that Howie identifies as being key. There's a good deal of simple, but perhaps again unappreciated practical advice here for how to pursue a more slow burn, long-term business. Even things like just backing up data that we may take for granted have to be approached differently if you're thinking over the span of many, many years in terms of getting as close to 100% reliability and resilience as possible. Permanence and that resilience are clearly qualities more important than flashy launches and splashy marketing. I thought at first the talk would cover the personal level more, but other than the introductory material on turning 40, most of it focuses on how choosing to go slow affects organizational decisions. Don't get me wrong, I think the advice, more the mindset he's advocating, is very valuable. It's a refreshing response to a lot of what I see as being wrong in the Valley. The one startup I worked for that got closest to this was the sanest, except for when they forgot the mantra of slowness and started changing business models, one of the things that he identifies as being a sign of trouble. The talk is about 40 minutes long. It's a bit of an investment, and if you're still in the private sector, though, it's definitely, I think, worth the time, even if Howie is a bit of a low-energy speaker. I've definitely seen ones that are more dynamic, but I think that actually matches well with the topic, oddly enough. working in the nonprofit sector now, I think the ideas and advice around long-term sustainability are applicable as well, given that the amounts of money are much smaller than in the private counterparts, and the cadence for seeking grants and developing corporate donations seems to be very different from the breakneck pace of today's startups to which Howie is ultimately reacting in this discussion. I wrote briefly, just on the website, about the Pirate Bay's announcement recently that they would be experimenting with serving magnet links from autonomous flying drones. The reaction to this has been mixed, with some finding it more credible, as I did, based on the state of the various technologies and tools available to enthusiasts that would be clearly required to deploy here. Others have been critical or even suggesting it was merely a joke, a bit of hyperbole. I even saw news and linked to it in this week's follow-ups that another group has already launched file-sharing drones, fitting this description, at least a proof of concept. One of my favorite authors, Charlie Strauss, has a nice recap of the original announcement on his blog and clearly falls into the more skeptical camp as he's talking about it. Being a fairly rigorous thinker as a, well, what some would call a futurist, I'm not sure that he would apply that label to himself, but definitely given the kind of science fiction that he does write, he provides one of the more compelling cases against the feasibility of these drones. Mostly, he identifies failure mode after failure mode that would make them subject to seizure, which is the real reason behind this whole idea of lofting these very modest file servers off into the sky, is to put them physically, literally, beyond the reach of authorities. For instance, to be truly autonomous and to perform active station keeping, they would outstrip the power that a light enough solar array could produce. Also, considerable power constraints in the radio emissions, both reception and transmission, in order to effectively communicate with ground stations, meaning they'd either need to be periodically refueled or would need some sort of a tether through which they could derive power. Rather than dismissing the whole notion, though, as some have, Charlie suggests an alternative. Like a lot of creative thinkers, he takes inspiration from nature. Well, in this case, it's a natural critter adapted to live where human populations are most dense. Charlie suggests that a Raspberry Pi, that's right, the low-cost, less than $50 USB connective computer, be used to power a rat bot, and this may be then a more feasible alternative to the LOSS idea put forward by the Pirate Bay crew. First, you avoid the complications that arise from flight, though I think he underestimates the remaining challenges for a terrestrial robot to navigate a changing and complex urban landscape. On the benefit side, though, he poses that such bots be deployed with similar quantities to their natural counterparts, that in some locales means that there's one rat within 3 meters of any given person. He even goes on to indulge in a bit more wild speculation on alternative power sources for these bots, such as microbial fuel cells, which have been researched with modest success. In city environs, he explains, this need not mean that the network providing rat bots be actual carnivores like some of the research subjects that precede this novel application, that they need not prey on other vermin to feed these fuel cells. Rather, he thinks that dumpsters, especially near where city-dwelling file sharers may congregate naturally anyway, could provide plenty of biodigestible material to power such systems and keep this army of automated pests going. If you take out the mobile robotic element, it isn't too far-fetched either, I think, to be fair, as all you are really talking about is an urban mesh network. Many such already exist, some of astonishing scale, often assembled by groups of volunteers in a very decentralized fashion. One of the challenges to deploying such networks is mapping out neighborhoods for optimal coverage. Making the actively participating nodes mobile, if that's possible, even if only modestly so, could be coupled with some simple routines for finding power and optimizing signal strength to nearest or proximal neighbors. I suspect Charlie is at least half joking with his suggestion too, but as another commentator defending the drone idea, the original idea here, contended, a lot of hacker projects start out merely as a joke, as wild bits of rhetoric. As computing power continues to get smaller and cheaper, as the Raspberry Pi demonstrates, more seemingly silly ideas will become low cost enough to try, regardless of whether they actually have much chance on paper of being successful. The cost of making an attempt would literally be less than proving it can't be done. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've discussed before. I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. The blog at Shapeways, the 3D print-on-demand service, had the good news that the academic project Open3DP at University of Washington is once again able to share its work. I have mostly blogged about this project as opposed to discussing it on the podcast. I had the great pleasure of meeting Mark Ganter, one of the folks behind Open3DP, last year. He is more of an artist than a techie, but also exhibited what I'd characterize as a strong activist streak. We talked mostly about the remaining patent-based constraints on homebrew 3D printing, in particular around powder bed printers versus the more common extrusion or the plastic-based printers maybe some folks are familiar with that they've seen at hacker events and makespaces. Open3DP has been pioneering a lot of materials and techniques here, despite those barriers, including demonstrating the ability to print wood, concrete, glass, and tea. Since October of last year, University of Washington had required that any potential collaborators enter into a cumbersome and non-open contracting arrangement in order to do so. Now, apparently due to the patience of Mark and his colleagues and to the credit of University of Washington, that policy has been reverted, allowing the project to share their work once again under Creative Commons licenses. Mike Masnick at TechDirt had the good news that the case from one musician who used Pi as an inspiration for a composition against another who released a video of his efforts on Pi Day, that's March 14th or 314 last year, has successfully been dismissed. Appropriately enough, the dismissal also came on Pi Day this year. Mike has tons of details if you're unfamiliar with the original story. He also includes a copy of the ruling and teases out some of the important bits. Overall, it's a good win for preserving the idea-expression dichotomy in copyright, a legal notion that is supposed to protect original expressions even if the idea on which they are based itself is not original. The judge also weighed in on the standard of substantial similarity, another legal concept that is supposed to protect works on the assumption that usually creative efforts tend to diverge, unlike inventions in the space of patents, which often are independently recreated or show signs of converging, of people arriving at the similar solutions or the same solution to similar problems. All in all, this is one case that has gone the way most such cases really should. It's a counterpoint to the trend of rulings on such claims that they tend to be read as broadly as possible to the detriment of the limits on copyright and the space we're supposed to have to pursue creativity more freely. Usually these go in the favor of some established artist and at the expense of a potential competitor and true innovator. Honestly, I genuinely wish such a ruling wasn't so newsworthy, but the fact that it is calls attention to how distorted copyright has become. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. The next show should go out in the feed and will be a feature cast as usual. This time I'm thinking about pursuing the topic of feeling your oats. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits, and you share your changes under the same license.